You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll talk to the Libertarian candidate in Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week was the sentencing of 16-year-old Dylan Yang, who was convicted of fatally stabbing a 13-year-old boy last year in Wausau. The case has garnered national attention from Hmong community leaders and critics of the criminal justice system.
Robert Menster joins us now for the details of that and other top news stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, the Dylan Yang case, this has been a really big story in the Wausau area, hasn't it?
Absolutely. In the Wausau area, it's galvanized the community here, and it's been something that has been spread across the country, particularly in the Hmong community. Dylan Yang is Hmong. He was 15 years old when he fatally stabbed a 13-year-old boy in Wausau during a fight between two groups of teen boys. This happened in February 2015. Yang was arrested. He was tried and found guilty as an adult, and he was facing up to 60 years in prison. The sentencing this week came out. The prosecutors asked for 25 years plus 20 years of probation. The defense asked for 1 year in prison and then 20 years of probation. And in the end, the judge sentenced Yang to 13 years behind bars, followed by 17 years of probation.
And there were strong emotions about this in the community, from the family of the victim and friends of the victim, from people connected to Dylan Yang and the Hmong community. Can you talk about some of the things you heard from both sides as this went on?
Well, this case was a tragedy. This is, no one argues that a 15-year-old boy is a fully formed adult, and this was a major part of Dylan Yang's defense, and the case was put forward during the sentencing, that a 15-year-old child's brain is not developed, impulse control is not that of an adult. They don't have the same level of culpability that we expect of an adult. There's a tragic element to the fact that this minor is facing all this time in prison, and certainly there's tremendous pain on the part of the family members of the victim, 13-year-old Isaiah Powell, many of whom were at the sentencing, who have spoken about their sense of loss and the life cut short of this young teen. This is a hard case to think too much about, and there's sort of no way to look at it and come out feeling good.
And it highlighted tensions between the Hmong community and others in the Wausau area, didn't it?
Certainly that's fair to say, and I think that it is. It really highlighted the sense to which there is people in the Hmong community feel like they are subject to racial profiling or treated differently within the justice system. There, it set off a lot of conversations about that. Dylan Yang chose to stab this boy, and the boy died. That is a crime, no matter how you look at it. But for certain, it's bound up with a sense about how people of color are treated in the justice system, and certainly it raises a lot of questions and questions that are worth discussing about how the justice system treats minors charged with crimes.
Talking to Robert Menster from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. I want to turn, Rob, now to Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race. Since the last time we talked to you, there have been not one but two Senate debates. I don't know why they were so close together, but there they were. Republican incumbent Ron Johnson, Democratic challenger Russ Feingold. Here's a little taste of Tuesday night's debate, showcasing some of the differences between the candidates.
Quite honestly, that encapsulates the difference in this race. Senator Feingold is always going to have a plan that grows government, and I hope Wisconsinites are smart enough that when you grow government, government is going to come and take more money out of your pocket.
Who is this guy going to vote with? Is he going to vote with me or somebody else? That's the fundamental issue, is who is the senator going to vote with? And I think I stand on firm ground that he votes with the big interests, and I doubt that I would.
So, Rob, a very clear choice for people in Wisconsin between these two candidates, a very distinct ideological and practical approaches to the way they work as senators.
For sure, I think it's a bit striking that the shape of this race has not changed. I don't see any evidence that that the two debates, you know, in any way are likely to change those sort of where the camps sit, right? So Feingold is a known quantity to people in Wisconsin. He was a longtime U.S. senator, and he was known as a quite liberal senator in his voting record. At the same time, he was a bit of he had a maverick streak. He worked on, you know, he had high profile bipartisan achievements and was willing to go against his party on a number of issues. Ron Johnson ran in 2010 as a businessman, as a political outsider, and this is the exact same race that we're having now. It's just that 2016 is a very different race than 2010.
Right. Presidential elections can change voter turnout in Wisconsin, who comes and votes in polls. And usually, as I understand it, that's seen as a benefit to Democratic candidates.
Right. I mean, I think that's right. The other thing that was notable in the second Senate debate is that, you know, it's weird that we're in this place, but this is where we are. That it is a newsworthy moment when Ron Johnson refuses to disavow support for the Republican presidential nominee. In the first debate, Johnson didn't even name Donald Trump. In the second debate, he did say that he sees both Donald Trump and himself as change agents, in the sense that they're not career politicians. Donald Trump's poll numbers in Wisconsin are not great. It does not look like Donald Trump is likely to win Wisconsin. So that in itself is a newsworthy event in the Senate race.
Well, speaking of polling, the Senate race, a Monmouth University poll released this week, shows a Russ Feingold with an 8-point lead over Ron Johnson, 52-44%. Based on what we've seen in the past, what did you make of those results?
Yeah, there were a small handful of polls that came out a couple weeks ago that seemed to show some tightening in the race. This Monmouth University poll showed a larger gap, a 52-44 gap. That was quickly followed by a poll from St. Norbert College that also had Feingold at 52%, and that one had Johnson all the way down to 40%. So, you know, at that point, it's hard to say. That's probably a little bit of an outlier, but it looks like the race is sort of stabilizing with Feingold around 50% and Johnson somewhere in the 40s, and it's hard with this amount of time left in the election season. It's going to be a big challenge for Johnson to sort of turn that dynamic around.
Well, that voting is a few weeks off, but one vote is already in. The group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce announced the winner of their coolest thing made in Wisconsin contest. They'd been taking nominees. They were on the show talking about that. They had some finalists. The winner is Harley Davidson, their new Milwaukee 8 engine motorcycle. One is the coolest thing made in Wisconsin. Rob, what's your take on this news?
Well, this was a good idea. I'm pro this contest, and I hope that it is turns into an annual tradition that we can vote for every year, because it's just sort of fun. And I don't, Rob, you know, the last thing I want to do is be accused of undermining the legitimacy of this election. But I'm not saying it was rigged, but the facts are that the finalists were these motorcycles, Johnsonville Brats, and a littoral combat ship by Marinette Marine. I mean, this is like a Navy vessel. This ship is amazing. How is this not the coolest thing made in Wisconsin?
Well, and you can make brats while you're on the ship, on the boat.
Sure.
But you can't make them on a Harley.
I like brats. Okay. Listen, I've got nothing against a Harley Davidson motorcycle. I mean, that's cool. There's a certain brand of cool around that. But this ship, it was amazing. Did you see the picture of this? It's 388 feet long. It's got a steel hull. It's got an aluminum superstructure. This is, to me, the coolest thing made in Wisconsin.
Rob, I'm going to ask you right here on the air right now, do you accept the results of this election?
Listen, I'm going to leave you in suspense. I'm going to keep you in suspense. We're going to look at it. We're going to look at how this election was conducted.
We can revisit that next week. Rob, thanks a lot for being with us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to discuss some of the top state news from the past week.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how much schooling Wisconsinites are getting, what it means for jobs and the overall state economy, and some insight into how the state and state leadership can invest to try to create jobs in Wisconsin. Big business, small business, old business, new business. Our guest will break it down for us.
But first, all this week, we've been interviewing Wisconsin congressional candidates who want your vote on Election Day.
Today, we'll take a look at the state's 4th congressional district. It includes a sizable portion of Milwaukee County and the entire city of Milwaukee, as well as the communities of Brown Deer, Bayside, Whitefish Bay, and more.
The district is currently represented by incumbent Democrat Gwen Moore, who has held the position since 2005. There's an independent candidate, Robert Raymond, in the race. The Republican candidate withdrew.
In just a few moments, we'll talk to the Libertarian challenger in the race, Andy Craig. Before we do that, we'll remind you that you can follow all of the election news you need at WisconsinVote.org. All of our candidate interviews and other information about how to vote, elections, where to go to vote, everything like that, WisconsinVote.org. And also go to WPR.org/politics and check out the new Wisconsin Public Radio political podcast. Back to our candidate interviews now with Libertarian challenger in Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, Andy Craig. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Well, first off, why are you running for Congress?
Well, in this race, there was not going to be a Republican running, and there ended up being another independent, but I know that at the time. And I feel very strongly that there should not be uncontested races for Congress, that any incumbent should have to defend their record and defend their position. And also, I think it's time we had representation for something other than Republicans and Democrats up there.
And right, you're running as a Libertarian. Why that party in particular for you?
I've been a Libertarian for a long time. I got involved with Ron Paul's campaign, and I've been heavily involved in Gary Johnson's campaign. I think, like a lot of Americans, I believe broadly in free markets and fiscal responsibility on the budgetary side. But I also believe in individual freedom, and I'm opposed to our never-ending foreign policy of wars. And so that there's not really anywhere to go in the Republican and Democratic parties for people who have that basket of views, which is a lot.
And, of course, your main opponent is the Democratic incumbent, Gwen Moore. Can you talk about what you would do differently, what policy steps you'd take that would work differently than what she's done?
Well, I would say one of the biggest things, I have endorsed the STOP Act, which is something that Representative Ribble has introduced that would prohibit members of Congress from doing what Gwen Moore spends most of her time doing now, which is having $1,000 plate fundraising dinners where she's selling access to her office. That's how she winds up with a campaign war chest of $800,000 in a nearly uncontested district. That's a big difference. I think Gwen, because she sees this as a safe seat, she's become a national party figure and less interested in representing Milwaukee.
A congressional approval is very low in the public eye right now. What do you think needs to change? How would you yourself help to change people's attitudes toward Congress?
Well, I think there has to be a bridging the gap. That, you know, the Republicans have some good ideas and the Democrats have some good ideas, but there's no bridge there between them. I think as a Libertarian, as a third party in Congress, we can bring the other parties to the table. Republicans on getting the budget under control, Democrats on things like drug policy reform and criminal justice reform. One of the big ones for me is that I'm appalled that Gwen Moore spent the Bush years in the Out of Iraq caucus, which was great. We should have gotten out of Iraq, never should have gotten in. But now that it's a Democrat in the White House sending the Wisconsin National Guard back to Iraq, she has nothing to say about it. I think we need a little bit more consistency principles underlying it, you know, other than who's what color hat is the guy at the top wearing right now.
Well, speaking of the person at the top of the ticket, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been issues for a lot of the people running for Congress. You mentioned that you're supporting the Libertarian presidential candidate, Gary Johnson. Can you talk about his prospects, your hopes for him in this election year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that we bring a national unity ticket to this election when both parties have nominated historically unpopular and disliked candidates. Gary Johnson and his running mate Bill Weld are both successful former governors who were elected as Republicans in heavily Democratic states. You know, they believe in less war, less debt, and more individual freedom, and that's a message that needs to be heard. And they should have been on the debate stage, just like Phil Anderson should have been on the debate stage with Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson, but they don't like that competition, so they don't let us up on stage with them.
We're talking to Andy Craig. He's the Libertarian candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 4th District in the Milwaukee area. Let's get into some policy areas, Andy. First of all, taxes and spending and the federal debt. What kind of things would you like to see change? What would you be supporting if you're elected to Congress?
Well, I think there's a common ground here. Gwynn and the Democrats talk a lot about wanting the burden of taxes to fall more heavily on the rich, and I don't entirely disagree with that notion, but there's two ways to do that. One of them is to raise rates at the top end of the income spectrum, and the other is to cut rates or abolish rates on the poor and the working middle class. I would introduce something I call progressive tax reform, which is, all right, we're not talking about debating the rich. Let's just put up the lowest income tax bracket, and do the votes exist in Congress to keep it, the 10% on up to $10,000 or whatever that lowest bracket is? And then we can move through them and see, you know, where there actually is support for maintaining the current tax rates, because I don't think the political support does exist for how heavy the burden is when you break it down like that. And that would include on the spending side. We have to see massive, spending reform. There's very little about the federal government that couldn't use a good 10 or 20% efficiency trim. And then on top of that, there are a lot of things that we can get the federal government out of completely while still taking care of the basic responsibilities.
What kind of things would you like to see cut completely from the federal budget?
I think the Transportation Security Administration is a good place to start if you want to talk about a woefully useless and horrendously expensive and costly imposition on Americans. I think the Department of Homeland Security as a whole has just proven to be another layer of bureaucracy. I do think we have to look at the entitlements and reforming that, and the big thing is we have to look at reducing military spending, which does get back to foreign policy and why we need to stop policing the world. But with that, I think we could quite easily and comfortably cut overall spending 20-25% without touching any of the core necessities of government.
Immigration's been a big issue in this in the presidential race, certainly in congressional races too. It's something that Congress will be tackling or trying to tackle, I'm sure, in the next session. What are your thoughts on immigration law?
I embrace immigration. Milwaukee in particular is a city that has been built on two things, immigration and free trade, and I support both of them. I don't think there should be, I think we should have, background checks. We should have, if you're a convicted felon or rules like that, but I don't think there should be quotas. I don't think there should be a numerical cap. Quotas on immigration don't work any better than the commissar setting quotas on bread. Either the jobs will be here or they won't. And I think people, should have the free ability to cross borders.
And you mentioned free trade as well. A lot of controversy over things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the International Trade Agreement, U.S. and Asian countries, arguments going back to NAFTA. What are your thoughts on free trade agreements?
I think here in Milwaukee in particular, we need export markets. Industries like CAT, like Johnson Controls, these are export-driven industries. And if there are huge trade barriers between us and those markets, it will be a net loss for Milwaukee. And it will be a net loss for the manufacturing industry in Wisconsin. The Trans-Pacific Partnership's not perfect. There are some carve-outs, there's some cronyism, there's some things I wouldn't have put in it. But on the whole, I think it is crucially important to, you know, not just for the economy, but also for world peace, to have the free and open movement of goods and services.
There's been concern about an uptick in violent crime in Milwaukee and some other major cities, while things not as bad as they were going back to, say, the 1980s. The numbers have gone up in the last couple of years. What would you see as the federal government's role in tackling a problem like that?
Primarily, that's going to fall to the state and local law enforcement system. I do think there's a federal role in civil rights. I think that some of these police shootings, there's a role for the Department of Justice. And I think there's a federal role in helping to figure out how we get away from this mass incarceration that is hollowed out the core of the African-American community in Milwaukee. When you're talking about 1 in 8 adult men in a population in prison, that's unconscionable, and it has effects. I think another thing that the federal government does have to do with it is that a lot of this is gang activity, and a lot, probably most, of the gang activity is driven by the black market trade in illegal drugs, which is immensely profitable. And that's an effect of the federal drug laws and the war on drugs approach that treats things like heroin as a criminal justice problem instead of a health problem, which is what it is.
Briefly, Andy, a last message to listeners, potential voters?
I would say that Gwen Moore's is coming on 12 years now in Congress. If she hasn't changed much by now, she's not going to do it with another 12 years. If you believe that we need more than just Republicans and Democrats represented in Congress, if you want the independent middle to have a voice, it starts by electing third-party members on your ballot, up and down your ballot, for all offices.
Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Andy Craig. He's running for Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District as a Libertarian candidate. He joined us as part of our ongoing series of candidate interviews. You can listen to interviews with candidates in other congressional districts at WPR.org.
Coming up, we look at a report on education attainment in Wisconsin and how it's impacting the state's economy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. This week, Ken and his guests dissect the third and final presidential debate and what it means for the road ahead. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, we take a look at a new report released from UW-Madison on how the changing labor force in Wisconsin is affecting the state's economic growth and development. One of the things the report looks at in particular, how jobs in the state are affected by the amount of time we Wisconsinites spend in school.
This week, there were reports that a record number of students around the country are graduating from high school. And over the last few years, Wisconsin has shown a particularly strong graduation rate. 88% of Wisconsin students graduated high school in 2013, based on the UW-Madison study. But despite those positive numbers, Wisconsin trails behind the rest of the nation in the number of college degrees.
Steve Deller joins us now to tell us more. He's professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He's one of the authors on the new UW-Madison study on the Wisconsin economy. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Let's start. There's a lot in this report. Let's start with this: these education rates. We're doing good on high school graduation, lower than average, it sounds like, on people with college degrees. Can you lay out some of the numbers for us?
Well, it's the specific numbers are actually, 29% of Wisconsin, the population of Wisconsin, 25 years and older, have a bachelor's degree or higher. Whereas compared to the U.S., it's 32.5%. We're a little bit behind Minnesota and Iowa. We're about on par with Illinois and about on par with Michigan. But overall, we have a very high school graduation rate, but it really drops off in terms of number of folks getting a bachelor's degree or higher.
Now, I think of this as kind of a demand-side thing. If there are a lot of jobs in the state that need that college degree, then more people get the college degree, the numbers will match up. it sounds like in the report there's a case to be made that it's actually a supply side, that if you build it, it being a lot of people with college degrees, they will come, the higher paying jobs that need those college degrees.
That's that is something that we really struggle with, how to lay this line of thinking out in a reasonable way. And you can really kind of think of about education policy and the decision to invest in education in one of two ways. One is kind of saying, you know, what are the current jobs out there right now? What's in the want ads, and what kind of skills are they required? And you invest in education that way. The other way is to kind of think about, well, what do we want the economy to look like 5-10 years from now, and what is going to be the future of the economy? And we should be investing in education to ensure that we're kind of steering the economy in a certain direction, a direction that we want. So one is reactionary, the other is kind of proactive.
How do we figure out what kind of economy we want, what kind of jobs we want to set that education policy?
Well, one of the things that's really driving a lot of the growth in Wisconsin is entrepreneurship, is business startups. And there's a fair amount of research out there that suggests that there's kind of a sweet point that essentially people with a bachelor's degree, and just a bachelor's degree, not more than a bachelor's degree, are more likely to start a business and more likely to be successful in their business. So if we want to try to promote entrepreneurship, the research is kind of suggesting that what we want to do is we want to promote people going to college and getting a degree, and that will help foster entrepreneurship into the future.
We'll get more into what kind of businesses, what kind of entrepreneurs most affect the state's economy. But staying with education for a moment, there's concern about this idea of the so-called brain drain. Great, somebody goes out, they get the degree, and then what, they move to New York, they move to California to work, we don't get the benefit. What does the reality look like in Wisconsin when it comes to brain drain, Steve?
You have to think about it, and it's two sides of the same coin. One is the amount of people with a college education that are moving out of the state, but also what is the flow of people with a college education coming into the state. When you look at the outflow, we're actually kind of below the national average in terms of losing people with a college education. There are folks moving out, but not as many as you might think, given Wisconsin. But what we really fall down on, where we fail, is the amount of brain gain, is the number of folks with college education coming into the state of Wisconsin. So when you look at the net, we're actually losing more than we're gaining. So I think it kind of turns it around. Rather than why are people leaving, the question really should be, well, why aren't people coming into the state?
And so for a policymaker, what do they do about that? What do they think about how to draw more people into the state with those college degrees? Hopefully those people who will generate some entrepreneurship.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is, what are the types of jobs that we are generating right now? Again, kind of back to that, what's the demand for labor right now? And if you look at the Wisconsin economy, the Department of Workforce Development puts out this kind of, they update it every few years, it's kind of a look into the future, a crystal ball look into the future. What do the what are the growth occupations out there? And one of the things that really startled us as we were putting this together was that about two-thirds of the forecasted jobs are going to require a high school diploma or less. That's startling, because a lot of those jobs are not very good paying jobs. So the question is that if the state is kind of moving in that direction, why is that attractive to people with a college degree? The other thing is that a lot of young professionals are kind of drawn to hip happening places, like a Denver or a Portland or an Austin, Texas, or a Twin Cities. We do see in Madison that kind of an effect. We see a lot of in-migration coming into Madison, and it's not just the UW. That's part of it. That's part of the mix. So the question really is that Madison has got this dynamics. Denver's got this dynamics. The Twin Cities has got this dynamics. The problem is that Madison is not big enough to pull the whole state up with it.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison. He's co-author of a new study on the Wisconsin economy, wide-ranging, looks at education, job creation, businesses. What kind of businesses create jobs in the state? And let's turn to that point, Steve. We've talked about this a little in the past. A lot of times we think of economic development, the headlines we see, the things that political parties talk about is, oh, hey, great news, we've attracted this existing company, it's bringing 50 jobs, 200 jobs in the state, or, oh, bad news, we're losing this company across the border. So it's a border war. We're fighting to keep existing legacy businesses or steal them from other states. Your report seems to suggest maybe another point of focus.
That's right. We get into this kind of recruitment game where we kind of say that what we're going to do is we're going to steal from our neighbors. And the way that we're going to steal from our neighbors is cut our taxes, cut our regulations, and kind of drive the cost of operation down. The problem, though, is that most businesses don't move. They really don't. Some of our previous work that we've talked about on the show suggests that at any given year, only about 3% of businesses move. And the vast majority of those that do move, move less than 10 miles. The engine of economic growth is entrepreneurship. And people who are starting businesses start their businesses where they live. So what we trying to draw attention to this one firm that moved into Kenosha, right? Mm-hmm. It was Kenosha?
Yeah.
Draws a lot of media attention. You know, we're talking about it right now. But if we had the same situation in Kenosha where you had 50 different small businesses pop up and each one employed two people, that wouldn't get any media attention at all. So we tend to kind of focus on the odd ducks that happen. And I think that one firm relocating was kind of an odd duck.
That's Colbert Packaging coming out from Illinois. That's
well, I don't mean the company's an odd duck.
Right, but that situation of that move, yeah.
That situation. Now, having said that, I do want to say that if we do want to get into that game of recruitment, now's the time to do it with Illinois. Illinois is really suffering right now because of their fiscal situation, and there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty as to what's going to happen in Illinois. Their fiscal house is just a disaster. And so you may have firms that are thinking about, well, I need to expand. The current site that I'm in is too small. I need to get bigger. I need to expand, and I can either move to the other side of town to a bigger facility, or I can move down the road a little bit. Oh, well, down the road happens to be over the state line.
But let's talk about those smaller businesses. And your numbers in the report, a lot of businesses are small, depending on how you define that. Small could even be one person, a carpenter who has a business, a
Correct.
Hairstylist, a piano tuner, I don't know.
Correct.
A lot of the businesses out there are a person, or maybe a person with a couple few employees.
Correct. One of the questions that this whole line of research is, what do you mean by small business? If you talk to the Small Business Administration, the way federal law is written, it's 500 employees or less.
That's a good size, 500.
That's big. That's a big company. You go into most small rural communities in Wisconsin, that's a huge company. So there's a bit of a definitional issue here, but I think when we talk about small business, we're looking at 20 employees or less, maybe even less than 10.
And we'll get into how to encourage the growth of those kind of businesses coming up. We're talking to Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He's got a new report out looking at how things like education attainment in Wisconsin affects jobs and what kind of businesses drive job creation here in the state.
And we want to hear from you. How much education did you get, and how did it affect you in the job market? Would you make the same decision again? Call 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are more people in your family or your community going to college more now than before? And if you hire people, tell us whether or not you expect candidates to have college degrees. Once again, our number is 1-800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing the conversation now with economics professor Steve Deller about a new report looking at the state's labor resources and how that's affecting Wisconsin's economic growth.
Steve is the co-author of a new report on the Wisconsin economy with Tessa Conroy and Matt Cures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did your education help you or not to get a job? If you hire people, college degree required, technical degree required, call and let us know at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Walter is with us in Wausau. Walter, hi.
Hello. Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure. What do you want to tell us about?
I graduated with a criminal justice associate's degree. I went to tech college out here, and the job market was pretty low, so I went and got my CDL, and now I drive trucks. Right now I'm at a fork in the road where I'm trying to decide whether I want to go get my bachelor's degree in a program called Integrative Leadership with an emphasis on emergency management, or if I should go into carpentry as an apprentice. And I'm trying to figure out what would be the best choice in this economy going the way it's going these days.
Walter, thanks a lot. Big decision and good luck making it. Steve, I don't know if you have specific advice, but looking at the job market out there, I imagine a lot of people are in Walter's shoes making comparable decisions. What kind of things do they weigh?
Well, it really depends on what you want to do. I mean, you know, it's always kind of the, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, I'm 56 and I still ask myself that question. but it really kind of depends on where you see yourself 10 years from now. If being in carpentry is something that you could find very enjoyable, something that you would enjoy doing, and, you know, realize that there will be periods when, you know, the economy takes a downturn and be prepared for that. I mean, that is something that you should pursue. Getting a college degree is not ideal for everybody, nor is it. I shouldn't really say that you have to have a college degree to be successful. My sister runs her own business and she barely made it through high school, but her business, she is extremely successful at her own business because she's passionate about what she does. So I think it's really finding something that you can really enjoy in life.
Thanks a lot, Walter, and good luck making that decision. Steve, so what can, say, the state or other leaders do to help people like Walter if he goes into carpentry and has a business, or your sister and has that business, the people who, many people who might be self-employed, maybe they're hiring just a couple of workers, and as you say, you get a bunch of those, that adds up to the same amount or more than that bigger factory.
Well, you have to realize that the state and local communities have different, what economists call, comparative advantages. A lot of the entrepreneurship is taking place at the local level, and a lot of the resources and the support has to occur at the local level. So it really is the community providing opportunities for these folks to network and get together formally and informally. Are there mentoring programs that can help an entrepreneur kind of figure out how to do this? Are there local educational programs? A lot of folks start their own business and they're passionate about what they do, but they're not a very good business person. So is there local support networks to help that? The state really is in a different position. The state is really in a better position to maybe help with financial programs and things like that. So there's different roles that can be played here.
Back to our callers now. Robert calling from Chicago. Robert, hi.
Yes, I came out of high school in Kansas and did a four-year tool and die apprenticeship program and then a year air conditioning and then did 4 years as an electrical construction apprentice and worked union all my life. The union got me good jobs and provided me now with a good pension. My son is 47 years old. He's got a master's degree in computer communications. We're here in Chicago at a three-day eBay conference, and he can't find a job, so he's thinking about getting a DSL license and becoming a truck driver. But, you know, you got to keep looking and keep your future open.
Robert, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Steve.
One of the things that when you find a career path that you want to go down, you find something that you're really passionate about and that you can enjoy, is that sometimes you have to be a little bit mobile. You have to be willing to say, look, I'm in the Chicagoland area, but I'm not finding the opportunities that are appropriate that I look forward to, but there are opportunities in, say, Austin, Texas. And are you willing to pick up and move? A lot of folks aren't willing to do that for a variety of reasons. But that's something that we have to, that folks have to kind of take into consideration.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Eric on the line in Milwaukee. Eric, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm enjoying your conversation, and I just wanted to share with you what I think with respect to education and jobs is that what I emphasize with my daughter, she's 12, is that, you know, we're not sacrificing as we are so that you can just, you know, need someone to have a job for you or have something for you to do. I try to instill in her that she can empower herself. I think the key to the economy, as Professor had mentioned earlier, is entrepreneurship. Once upon a time, every company that exists did not, but does because someone found something with whatever resource they have to start a business. We are conditioned society to think that we have to find someone who has something for us to do as opposed to whatever it may be. My daughter, she sells pens at school and does other things to make money and impresses me with that. Now, when I do my own business, I bring her with me to help her show her how you don't have to wait and hope and pray for someone to have something for you to do in order to support yourself. If you have a brain, you have a healthy body, you can start your own business. There's something to be said about the freedom of self-employment and entrepreneurship. And it's entrepreneurship which drives the economy, as the professor said. It's not jobs. It's entrepreneurship.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. And Steve, you focus on this a fair amount in the report, the role of new businesses in driving job creation.
That's right. I think that everything that Eric said I would agree with is that an education creates opportunities. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to, you know, if I get a degree in mechanical engineering, that means I have to go into that field. But it creates opportunities for folks. And again, it's that kind of the exposure to critical thinking, to problem solving, to teamwork, the kind of thinking on your own is really vital to being a successful entrepreneur. So it's almost gearing up for decisions that you can make down the road.
Eric, thanks for that call. I'll probably be working for your daughter in maybe 10, 20 years. Good luck to her. We're talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison, co-author of a new report on the Wisconsin economy, looking at education, jobs, job creation, economic development. Back to our callers now with Tom in Menominee. Tom, hi.
Hello. I'm up in the Shell Lake area, and I happen to hear you guys talk about this subject, and it happens to be one of my passions in life, and that is, it doesn't matter if an individual gets a 2-year degree, if they get a 4-year degree, but the most important thing is you have to like what you do. And you need to find that passion. You need to find that desire as to what you want to do in life. I've spent over 35 years as a teacher in the 2-year technical college system. I've seen people come into the system with little education. I've seen them come into the system with 4-year degrees and even higher than a 4-year degree. But the bottom line is, whatever you do, you have to find your passion. You have to find what you desire and you want to do. And I'm a graduate of a 2-year technical college. I'm a graduate of University of Wisconsin at Stout. And I can honestly say that the bottom line here is, if you're going to go for any type of job in the world, don't make it a job, but make it a passion.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. I want to bring in Steve. Maybe easier said than done, but is there something to what Tom's saying?
I think it is. I think it's, when I talk to my son, it's always, do you want a job or do you want a career? And the word passion, I think, is the word that Tom used, and I agree with it 100%. I could have followed my father into the private sector and made a lot more money than I make as a university professor, but I love what I do, and I'm willing to take a lower pay to do what I love doing.
Briefly, Steve, as we wrap up, you've got this new report out. What are you hoping people do with it?
I'm hoping that we kind of, it's part of a series of reports, studies that we're putting out, and I'm hoping that we kind of start thinking a little bit more long-term in terms of our economic growth and development policies, that it's not kind of a knee-jerk, short-term race to the bottom, but kind of taking the high road and realizing that we got to think longer term.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Talked to us about education and Wisconsin's labor market. He's co-author of a new report on Wisconsin's economic growth and future development. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Central Time.